Well, nice rainy day. Perfect for the subject today. And I noticed in Obie's magazine, which we have another supply of, he covered, he's got an article there that deals with the same subject, the early and the latter rains. This is going to be what I could call a part two to the last message on the last great day, because I want to cover some more of that information, but in a broader sense. I'd like to step back and look at the fall holy days in a broader perspective. Sometimes, or typically, we talk about each of the days individually, and we don't necessarily consider them as a greater whole. And that's what I want to do today, to step back, look at all of the fall holy days, because they relate to this event or this situation that we call, or that the New Testament calls, in fact, the Old Testament refers to it, the early and the latter rains. I remember as a kid hearing that subject, and I don't know that the people referring to it at the time understood it. This was in a Protestant church. But they at least knew something, that there is more than one harvest that God is going to reap from humanity, from His creation. There's a great conundrum in religions of the present day, and for that matter, for centuries. It's the enigma of death without any opportunity for salvation. When you think about it, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of situations that you could picture in your mind where people have lived and died who never had a chance for salvation. Most obviously, infants who die very young, or young children. You have many people who've lived in parts of the world where there was never any opportunity for them to know. No one ever evangelized those areas. You have millions of people who lived and died long before Christ was on earth. What about them? Will they ever have an opportunity? They're dead now. They're unconscious. They have no ability to make any kind of a choice or any kind of a change in their life. Now, we all know that scripture that talks about God is not willing that any should perish. But looking at it practically, looking at it from the way we would look at it, it seems rather odd that the vast majority are perished or perishing. It's the rare individual who has heard God's truth and responded to it in a proper way. If God is not willing that any should perish, it seems like He ought to have a plan to go along with that, to where no one would have to perish unnecessarily. The vast majority aren't converted. Both in ancient history, more recent history, or the present day. The vast majority have never really heard the truth or have never really had an opportunity to respond to it. I want to sidestep the persuasion that teaches that people immediately go to their eternal reward at the time of their death. I want to narrow it down a little bit to our genre of beliefs. There are those in our greater fellowship sphere who hold to their being two resurrections. And it's kind of hard to deny that, at least from Revelation chapter 20, verse 5, which talks about there being a resurrection before the millennial age and another one after. So we know there has to be two. And most people acknowledge that much at least. But when you assign your mind to thinking that there is but two, it creates a number of problems. And it's that area that I want to expand our thinking on and draw in a little more to understand God's plan for mankind. Because while he is not willing that any should perish, he has made provision for that. And we understand that from the greater scope of the fall holy days. Now, we realize that the holy days, the spring set of holy days, deal with the issue of personal salvation. But the fall holy days address themselves to the greater issue of world salvation. It's that block of holy days that I want to step back from and look at from a distance, look at in their overall context. And in that we can see how God plans to make it so that no one need perish who doesn't specifically want to. In other words, all who have ever lived will have opportunity. Those who in this life have had opportunity are exempt from this particular set of dealings. But it's the greater number who never did have opportunity. That is the number that God has singled out and identified through his plan of how he will make it possible for them to have what they in their lifetimes never had. We have the Feast of Trumpets, which begins the fall set of holy days. And in that, we detect reference to the second coming. We detect the saints being raised immortal in the first resurrections. We see in the Feast of Trumpets all the nations of the world being taken over by Christ to be ruled by him and his now immortal saints. In the Feast of Atonement, we detect elements of a oneness of world government. We see Satan being driven out of society. And we see a oneness where each individual can become one with God. Now, Christ's sacrifice is also alluded to in the Day of Atonement. And we say, well, wasn't that covered in Passover? Well, yes, it is. But remember that atonement is individual or personal. This atonement is for the world to also become one. We see Christ's sacrifice in the Day of Atonement being extended to the entirety of humanity. And then the Feast of Tabernacles, where we see a world living the right way, a world full of peace and prosperity. But we also see a generation living in the millennial age where the opportunity for salvation is fully open to all. We have to ask ourselves, what did the early church know? After all, they were the generation that produced the scriptures that we have before us. What did they know and how did they know it? And why does religionity today, in general, not understand something so very basic? There's basically two questions that I want to pose and I want us to keep in our mind as we listen today. Question number one is, how can a righteous God consign people to eternal death who never had a chance? If someone never had a chance, how could it be right? How could it be a righteous thing to consign them to eternal death? Second question. When will those people who are converted after the second coming be brought into the Spirit-born family of God? Do we have good answers to these things? Are these questions that the religious world would even be able to explain? Religion, for the most part, doesn't even allow that there is such a period as a second harvest. But the early church understood it. And we can see that from a place like James chapter 5. James is not introducing something new to them. This isn't something that they never heard of or that they needed to have explained to them. James chapter 5, verse 7. Where James says, "Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of our Lord. Behold, the husbandman waits for the precious fruit of the earth and has long patience for it until he receive the early and the latter rain." They knew what he was talking about. He didn't need to explain it to them. Do we understand what he was talking about? It's not that complicated. The early and the latter rains refer to that fact that there is going to be two harvests of humanity for the family of God. Notice he puts it in the context of a farmer cultivating a crop. Behold, the husbandman, that's the farmer, waits for the precious fruit of the earth. The earth is going to produce a crop. In this case, it's not a crop of vegetables or fruit from a tree or grapes or anything like that. This is a crop of individuals, of people, for his family. That's the precious fruit he's talking about. The early church understood that, and they understood it from some other references. It's referenced in Deuteronomy, and it's referenced again in Deuteronomy 11 and Hosea 6. So this is not a new thing. This is something that was understood from ancient times. But the early church understood that there are to be two harvests of humanity. Most people in our world represent there being just one. By keeping the spring and fall holy days, we can gain a general sense of the purpose of these harvests. They illustrate a lesser harvest, what we call first fruits, followed by a later and much greater harvest, that of ingathering, later in the year. In Revelation 20, we are made very aware of the fact that there is to be a resurrection prior to the millennial age. And then it's very specific that there is to be another resurrection after the 1,000 years are finished. So we've got at least two. Let's turn to Revelation 20. There'll be some things there that I want to point out. Revelation 20. And when you consider this chapter analytically, you realize that this is a very revealing passage of Scripture. Now think about that resurrection that's going to occur after the 1,000 years. If that were a sentencing, why would you need to wait 1,000 years for it to take place? Why couldn't that be right away? What is the purpose of a resurrection with such a delay? Now, we've got another problem. There are going to be people who live during the 1,000 years, and I would say multiple millions, maybe billions, who are converted. What about them? They're going to live and die normally, just as we do today. Lifespans are not going to be dramatically different. People will live normal lives. They may have different health situations than we have today. But what of them? In that group who live in the millennial age, there's going to be people converted and unconverted. There's going to be both. By the end of the 1,000 years, the vast majority of them will have already entered their graves. They will have died, with just one final generation living at the end of the 1,000 years. And those people will be they who were the descendants of those who survived physically through the Great Tribulation. The world is going to be repopulated. The kingdom of God is going to be populated by people who are the descendants of the survivors. There will be a physical generation living under the spiritual governmental structure of the millennial age. They are going to be people much like people today. They're going to live in a different climate, a different religious climate. But they're going to be normal people. At the end of the 1,000 years, there's going to be another resurrection. Why wait? What's the purpose of that? If that resurrection, this is the point I want to make, if that resurrection is for sentencing, why would you need to wait till after the 1,000 years? Something we need to think about. Could it be, could the reason be for the delay, the simple fact that a righteous God could not consign the vast majority of them to eternal death in the lake of fire because they never had opportunity? We've been talking about people who never had an opportunity, and there's a great number of them. Is the purpose of that resurrection at the end of the 1,000 years not for sentencing, which logically it wouldn't make sense to wait for that? Could the purpose of that resurrection at the end of the 1,000 years be to open the opportunity for those who never had opportunity? And that has got to be the vast majority of people who ever lived. That era that occurs after the second resurrection is what we call the Great White Throne Judgment. In fact, it's Revelation 20 that gives us that particular name. Let's just scan Revelation 20 for a minute and see what it shows us. In chapter 20, the first few verses, it talks about Satan being bound. And this is right after Christ's return. We see some reference to that in the Day of Atonement, where Satan is going to be removed from society. Verse 3 tells us he's going to be loosed for a little season afterward, but we'll come to that. And then in verse 4, it begins to talk about the saints of God ruling with him for 1,000 years. Verse 5, it talks about the rest of the dead live not again till the 1,000 years were finished. These in verse 4 are they who come up in the first resurrection. Verse 6 tells us they will live and reign with Christ 1,000 years. And then in verse 7, it refers to Satan being loosed out of his prison after the 1,000 years are finished. And he's going to go out to deceive the nations in all directions of the earth and to gather them to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. That final generation from the millennial age is going to produce this army. He is going to be successful in deceiving many people. Why is that? When we understand the purpose for the second resurrection, it makes perfect sense. Because those who come up in the second resurrection are people who lived in the society just as we do, having been exposed to Satan, deception, his attitudes, his perversions, all of their lives. But let's be realistic about the millennial generation. Nobody is going to be born converted. It's not automatic. Just as now, anyone living in the millennial age, even though they're living in a very different kind of world, they are still going to have to make decisions. They are still going to have to overcome themselves. They are still going to have to go through the process of becoming converted. And there are many who will not. We can see that in this army that Satan is going to raise just out of that final generation. What God is doing is he's using Satan to call out of the final generation of the millennium those people who would, can we say, inject attitudes into those being raised. Those being raised will have been very familiar with Satan and his ways and his kind of thinking. Think how they would react if they were raised up into a world that was filled with a number of people who still resented God, who were not converted. It would diminish their opportunity. Those who come up in the second resurrection are going to come up into a world that is absent of Satan, his demons, his deception, and the spiritual evil that filled the world that they had lived in previously. They're going to come up into a society with a righteous and just government. They're going to come up into a world who has had 1,000 years economy, absent of war and evil intentions and all of the horrible economic catastrophe of the results of war. They're going to come up into an economy that is prosperous, a society without religious deceptions or controversy. All will know the truth. God wants to cleanse the final generation of the millennial age of people who are hostile to him, who resent his ways, before he brings these others into it. Now, what we can see from that is that the people who come up in the second resurrection are going to have the greatest possible opportunity for salvation that anyone could ever have. We see the term, the great white throne judgment. And if we consider that term, we can see how appropriate it is. This is a judgment period not for sentencing, but for evaluation. In our recent Bible study, we talked about this. Judgment has more than one meaning. We tend to think of judgment in the sense of condemnation, where it's not just that. In any judgment process, for it to be legitimate, there has to be a period of time of evaluation. The court has to hear the evidence. They've got to get their facts straight in order to make a just and right sentence. No less so with God. He wants those people that he raises up to give opportunity for salvation, he wants them to have the best possible environment in order for them to lay out their record. Not the record of their past, but the record of their present. You see, it isn't just a matter in this case of considering the evidence of what they did in the past. It is for them to set the record by their lives. They're going to live again with opportunity. Think about the world that they're going to have. It's going to be a world that is sanitized of all the evil elements. It's going to be a world that has right government and justice reigning everywhere. It's going to be a world where the other people in that society will have been cleansed of any negative regard that they might have for God and His ways. He is giving them the best possible opportunity that they could ever have. Now, does something like that describe the love of God? Could anything describe it better? This is the plan that God has. He's not willing that any should perish. And more than that, He's made provision that no one perish needlessly. If anyone does perish after these events, if anyone does perish having lived in the millennium, if anyone does perish having lived in the post-millennial age, that age which we call the Great White Throne Judgment, which is not a day, it's a period of time, at least one generation long. But if anyone lives through these periods of time still unconverted, they can't blame someone else. It would only be them and the result of their own choices. We've talked in the past about what Christ said in John chapter 6, the Gospel of John. And this passage is easily understood in the context of this subject of the early and the latter rains. John 6, verse 44. We all know it by heart. No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. No man can come to me. He's saying it's the Father's choice. But yet over in chapter 7, verses 37 and 8, he seems to be contradicting himself. Here Christ says, in the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believes on me, as the scriptures have said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. This passage seemed to indicate that it's a personal choice. How do we explain that? Well, actually, it's easily explained. And it dovetails perfectly with this subject of the early and the latter rains. Because you see, John chapter 6 is in the context of a spring holy day season. You can see that in verse 4 of chapter 6, where it says, and the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. This chapter 6 is in the Passover season. But if you go to chapter 7, verse 2, now the Jews' feast of tabernacles was at hand. So it isn't the contradiction, but there is a difference. It shows the difference. Those who are in the first harvest are those who are called, who are identified by God the Father, and who are specifically called into that first harvest, the first fruits harvest. But in the context of the Feast of Tabernacles, in the context of the fall set of holy days, it's a whosoever will situation. Look at chapter 7, verse 38. He that believes on me, as the scriptures have said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. Now compare that with Revelation chapter 22. Revelation 22, verse 17, or thereabouts. Verse 17, and the Spirit and the bride say, come. Who are they, the Spirit and the bride? These are they who are going to be ruling in the millennial kingdom. The Spirit and the bride say, come, and let him that hears say, come. In other words, people are going to be encouraging each other. And let him that is athirst come, and whosoever will let him take the water of life freely. This water of life, this indwelling of God's Spirit, is going to be freely available to anyone who wants to avail themselves of it. That's the difference between John 6:44 and 7:37. It alludes to the early harvest and the late harvest. Understanding these things is one of the benefits that we get from understanding the biblical holy days. The holy days are oriented around agricultural harvests, and that's how people in ancient times generally understood them, but the pattern was in there. And if they were perceptive, they could pick it up. The agricultural harvests illustrate the two-phase spiritual harvests of humanity. The early church observed these days, and as a result, the early church had some awareness of what we today understand. In Colossians 2:17, the Apostle Paul refers to the holy days as a shadow of things to come. There was some point in time between the time of Moses and the present day where the understanding of the holy days shifted from a historical context to a prophetic context. God's holy days are prophetic. They teach us things about God's plan that he is going to implement before the full end of the age. There's also some allusion to this back in Revelation chapter 20. And let's draw out this component as well, where he talks about the period of time that we know as the second resurrection era. Verse 11, "And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works." Think about it. The dead, small and great, are going to stand before God, and the books are going to be opened. What are the books? We understand the books to be the books of the Bible. Are going to be opened to their understanding, an understanding that they never had in their previous lifetimes. How many times have you met people who admit they just don't understand the Bible? They just don't. They could read it. They understand the language. They're fluent in English. They could read these and just don't understand. And I'm sure we know many people, whether they try or whether they don't try, who simply don't understand. Why is that? But before we leave this verse, let's focus on the point here. The books are going to be opened. Well, there's no point in opening a book if you're not going to examine the contents. And the reason for the context of the contents of the Bible is to lay out a way to live. People are in this that it's referring to in verse 12 are going to be those people who are given the opportunity to understand and to live by the words. But then it says another book is open. The book of life. What's the point? Why would you open the book of life at this point in time? Whose names are in it? The only names that there could be in it are those people who came up in the first resurrection were already made spirit. What do you need the book of life to know who those people are? The book of life is opened to these people who come up in the second resurrection for the purpose of adding their names into it. Then we go to verse 13, which seems to be saying the same thing again, but actually it isn't. And I'll explain that to you. Verse 13 says, "And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works." You have a judged in verse 12, and you have a judged in verse 13. Are they both the same thing? I pose to you that those in verse 12 are evaluated, are evaluative judgment, where those in verse 13 are sentenced. Because it goes right into verse 14 and says, "Death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire." Right in that verse alone, we have proof that names are going to be added to the book of life after Christ's second coming. Otherwise, there'd be no names in there, because they would have already been made spirit, not subject to the second death. It says that over in verse 6. "Blessed is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power." So those whose names are in the book of life is not these in the first resurrection contingent. There's new names added. Do we understand when and how those new names are going to be added into the book of life? The millennial age is going to add a lot of names. And this second resurrection, this great white throne era, is going to add a lot more names. And that in the final sentencing that we see in verse 13... that is the point in time when each of these individuals are going to be sentenced. And keep in mind, the greater number of these people are going to already be in their graves. So they're going to have to be raised again for sentencing. That's important that we understand. Now, if we could make a comparison over with John chapter 5, we can add a little more to this, because John chapter 5 covers the same situation, these various resurrections. John 5. And I want to point out something here. If you take John 5 and Revelation 20 and harmonize them together, they expound on one another. John 5, verse 24, refers to the first resurrection. Verse 25 refers to the second, and I want to call out a point here. John 5, 25, "Truly, truly, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live." They that hear. Notice that. Does that suggest that some will hear and some won't? Well, what we understand about the second resurrection, that it does not raise up those people who already had an opportunity for salvation and who rejected it. There are those who will hear and those who will not. But then go to the next verse. "Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in the which all that are in the graves shall hear his voice. And shall come forth, they that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation." The people who come up in this verse 28 resurrection are going to be those who are both converted and unconverted. What resurrection is that? In Matthew 25, we have a very positive statement that Christ himself gave. And it starts in verse 31. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, this is the second coming, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall be gathered all nations. And he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on the right hand, but the goats on the left. You can read the rest of this. This is a resurrection that describes righteous and unrighteous people coming up together, being physically separated from among one another and sent to their eternal reward, whether good or bad. What resurrection is that? That's the question we need to answer. When we step back and look at God's fall holy days, from a broader perspective, we see that he has made provision for people to become converted who never had the opportunity to become converted. I want to read a passage to you that I think is very, very revealing. It's found in Romans chapter 11. Romans 11. See, the Apostle Paul understood this issue as well. Romans 11, and keep in mind that he is quoting from Isaiah chapter 29. But in Romans 11, beginning in verse 7, what then? Israel has not obtained that which he seeks for, but the election have obtained it, and the rest were blinded. Can we understand verse 7 in the context of the early and latter rains, the early harvest and the late harvest? Israel, the people, God's chosen people, has not obtained that which he seeks for. But he says the election were obtained it. Who are the election? They're the ones that Christ referred to in John 6:44. No man can come to Christ unless the Father draws him. Those are the election. The election has obtained it, and the rest were blinded. God drew a veil across the eyes of a certain contingent of people. And in doing so, he says something very amazing. We'll come to that. Let's read on. According as it is written, God has given them the spirit of slumber. And where it is written is in the book of Isaiah. Eyes that they should not see and ears that they should not hear unto this day. Down to verse 11. I say, have they stumbled that they should fall? God forbid. But rather, through their fall, salvation has come unto the Gentiles for to provoke them to jealousy. God is going to use the election to provoke an emotional reaction of his intended people, his called people, for a particular reason. He wants the greatest yield possible. I think it's down in verse 32. Even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy they also may obtain mercy. For God has concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy on all. Now, if God is going to close someone's eyes, close someone's understanding, to the opportunity for salvation, how could he call that mercy? How is that being merciful? Oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God, how unsearchable are all his judgments and his ways past finding out. Well, have we, through the holy days, found out something? These whom God has blinded, he is going to bring up again and set them in a perfect environment for them to have no reason for not becoming converted, other than possibly their own personal mental flaws or character flaws. God is going to have mercy upon all in the fact that he is going to give them their opportunity period during that interval of time where there's no Satan, where there's no negative element in society, where they have a perfect government, where the earth is full of the knowledge of God. They don't even need to teach each other anymore. They're going to all know it. This is how God is going to have mercy on those people he has blinded. Now, he could call them. He could call them en masse. But think about it. If he did, what percentage would end up becoming converted? Let's ask the question another way. If he were to call them in the Great White Throne Judgment era, into that perfect world, what percentage there would become converted? Can you see how God's blinding them would be merciful? From an overall picture, or from an overview of God's holy days, and understanding how these various ages and how the various resurrections work, we can understand God's plan for mankind. Not only is he not willing that any should perish, but he has also got a plan that as few as possible. Let's go back to our two questions that I started with. How can a righteous God consign peoples to eternal death who never had a chance? And we can certainly describe people who we know who never had a chance. Well, the answer is God has a plan. Those plans incorporate two harvest periods, which will ultimately provide opportunity for all. Would the world's religions give you that answer? Second question, when will those converted after the second coming be brought into the spirit-born family of God? I think Matthew 25 tells us that, the sheep from the goats. Those who are converted after Christ's second coming will live and die just as now. Those who come up in the second resurrection will live out one full lifetime, giving them the opportunity that they never had. And then all of those who are in their graves at that point in time will be brought up together for sentencing at the very end. That's the thing that we read of in Revelation chapter 14. And we've talked about this chapter at our Bible studies, and it's also a chapter in my Millennial Kingdom booklet. Revelation 14. When we understand the context of this chapter, we realize it's talking about the early and the latter rains. It's talking about these harvests. We see the first harvest of the 144,000, the first fruits harvest, in verses 1-4. These are they, verse 4, which are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. And then in verses 6, 7, and 8 is a message that goes out to the survivors of the Great Tribulation, explaining the religious system that is going to begin at that point in time. And in verse 14, the second harvest. This is the great white throne. I'm sorry, this is the sheep from the goats harvest at the end of the great white throne, where we see someone with the appearance, looks just like Jesus Christ, sitting on a white cloud, and he puts his sickle in and he reaps the harvest of the earth. He reaps those for his kingdom. This is that point in time when those who are converted after the second coming will be brought into God's family. But he leaves quite a number. And we read of them in verse 17, and another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, and he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, which had the power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And that angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horse bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. These people, in this second group, the goat contingent, we could call them, these people who did not accept Christ's blood to pay the penalty for their sins, will pay for them with their own blood. It's not that complicated. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. The wages of sin is death. That's always true. That will always be true. Sin will be paid for by the shedding of blood, either Christ's or their own. And that's what we're looking at in chapter 14 of Revelation. These are the full scope of the harvests of the world, the first harvest in the first few verses. And the second harvest in the final half of the chapter, the great white cloud situation, which is a day, not necessarily a great period of time, as opposed to the great white throne, which is a period of time. So we have an answer to the questions. A righteous God is not going to consign people to eternal death who never had a chance. He has a plan to give them an opportunity. Those who are converted after the second coming will be raised and brought into the family of God, not unlike what is going to happen to the first fruits generation. We are going to be raised from the dead, or if living, instantly changed into spirit beings, as we read of in 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians 4. It won't be that much different for them. Except that the first fruits have a higher reward. We sang of that in one of our songs. That is the privilege of being called now. And keep in mind that those called now, their names have been specifically identified by God the Father. He says, this one can make it. I'm going to call that person now. We can learn a great deal from God's holy days.